ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, I'm Nick Grimm, and this is PM, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, the only way is up. The new advice on how to boost housing supply and bring down home prices. Also, Typhoon Kalmagi continues to cut a deadly, destructive swathe through Southeast Asia. And they're watching over our cities, guarding against chip thieves. We go on the beat with the canine members of the Seagull Patrol.
The seagulls sitting on the backs of the chairs and on the tables, ready to pounce.
So people actually come there just to see the dogs. We've had people get off the ferry there and just walk round to the Opera House, not to see the Opera House, but to meet the dog.
Australian cities have some of the lowest housing density in the world, so as the nation continues to grapple with the housing crisis, there's a renewed push to build up, not out. Now a new report from think tank the Grattan Institute argues three-storey unit blocks and townhouses should be allowed on all residential land in our cities. That might be a moot issue, though, with industry saying the number one problem holding up supply is a lack of skilled workers able to build new homes. Eliza Getzey reports.
Builders are busy on the outskirts of Australia's largest and most expensive city, Sydney. This site's supervisor, Brian Skinner, says demand is growing rapidly.
Yeah, the interest rates have dropped. There's a bigger demand. More clients are starting to buy. Keeps the supervisors pretty busy.
Builders and experts agree building out isn't enough to reach the federal government's target of 1.2 million homes in the next 4 years. Think tank the Grattan Institute says one solution is building up, creating denser cities and homes where people want to live.
The reality is Australian cities are some of the least dense of their size in the world. We haven't allowed enough housing in those areas where Australians most want to live, in those inner and middle ring suburbs of our capital cities.
That's the Institute's housing program director, Brendan Coates.
The key reform here is that we need to allow gentle density townhouses and apartments of up to three stories on all residentially zoned land in our major cities, as well as upzoning for high density apartments around major transport hubs and commercial centres. That would unlock millions of additional opportunities for more housing in our major cities, and that ultimately is how we'll make housing cheaper, by making it more abundant.
Its report proposes a loosening of regulations that it says could add 67,000 new homes a year and slice $100,000 off the median house price by filling the missing middle. Nicole Garin is a professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Sydney.
Well, look, honestly, who would disagree with that? We've been talking about trying to densify our cities, and we've succeeded in doing that in many parts of Sydney, Melbourne, and, you know, the other Australian capital cities.
She says states, territories, and local government have done a lot of work on planning systems.
Probably time to see, you know, whether that work bears fruit. And I think the question is whether, you know, there's more that can be done with even more big claims about reform, when what we actually see is quite a lot of homes under commencement. But what we do have is another 35,000 homes that have been approved and haven't commenced. And that's the real issue that we face when it comes to supply in Australia, is feasibility.
Professor Garin argues Australia needs to examine what's holding up projects. For Matthew Pollock from Master Builders New South Wales, the answer is simple.
Workforce shortages seem to be a perennial challenge for the construction industry at the moment. If we're going to build more homes, then we need more boots on the ground to do that. You know, more investment into the workforce, particularly into TAFE and training, but also for employers to take apprentices on.
Housing Industry Association Chief Executive Jocelyn Martin says there's one massive and largely untapped labour force. Women.
In a sector where you essentially are only attracting 50% of the population, then inevitably you're going to have a skills shortage. And our challenge as a sector is to encourage more women into construction, to educate them about the different types of careers that they can have. That then, you know, trades are one pathway, but design pathways, planning, certification, we need all those skills as well.
The federal government says its effort to build more homes is bearing fruit, with the Bureau of Statistics reporting a 12% rise in dwelling approvals in September. That's up close to 30% from a low point in February 2024.
That report from Eliza Getzey and Isabel Massali. It's not something any parent does lightly, but when someone lodges a complaint about their son or daughter's childcare centre, it's fair to say they'd expect something to be done about it. An ABC investigation has revealed no action was taken on nearly 10,000 complaints reported to South Australia's childcare regulator. Of those that did trigger a response in recent years, just one provider had their registration cancelled and a further 10 were suspended. Catherine Birmingham reports.
Parents and carers with kids at childcare are used to a few bumps and scratches. But family advocate Georgie Dent says it's rare for a parent or carer to make a formal complaint unless they're seriously worried.
I just cannot fathom that parents would be ringing or making complaints in circumstances where they're not really concerned about something.
The CEO of The Parenthood says she's concerned about figures that show more than 9,000 complaints to South Australia's childcare regulator were investigated but resulted in no action.
Australia is confronting the fact that the regulation of early childhood education and care right around the country has been problematic, and I think that it is fair to say that it has not been robust enough to ensure that the safety and well-being of children is the absolute paramount priority.
The South Australian figures, obtained under Freedom of Information laws, show nearly 6,000 of the complaints to the Education Standards Board were about for-profit providers. 10 providers were suspended from operation and 4 were issued with show cause notices. One provider had its registration cancelled outright between January 2020 and October 2024.
It's not the ultimate goal to cancel every provider that's out there. That's not what we're about, but we do need to take the right action.
Ben Grimola is the chief executive of the Education Standards Board. He believes the lack of action could come down to the severity of the complaints.
We investigate every complaint that comes in, and where there are risks, we follow that up and go through and make sure that if there is any further action, compliance action, anything to do with a complaint, we follow it up immediately.
A recent state parliamentary committee heard 17% of South Australian childcare centres aren't meeting national quality standards. But Ben Grimola says he's determined to hold childcare providers to account.
I do believe, you know, we can do a lot more in this space and we will continue to do that. And part of that is really making sure that people understand that if you do the wrong thing, we will take action.
The Education Standards Board is independent from the South Australian government. But the state's Education Minister, Blair Boyer, has acknowledged the regulator has fallen short in some cases.
I think we've come from a position where because our regulator didn't have the resources they needed, didn't have the muscle and teeth that they needed, that there wasn't the propensity to take those things any further.
Only 181 of the more than 1,300 childcare services registered in South Australia were assessed and rated in the 2024-2025 financial year. The Education Minister says that's an increase on previous years. He says the regulator now has more funding and more staff to keep a close eye on the childcare sector.
But I think we'll come down the other side of that and be in a place where we can better look parents in the eye when they drop their kid off at long daycare, that you have a very well-regulated system where people know that if they don't do the right thing, the regulator will find out and the regulator will use every power it has to stamp it out.
South Australian Education Minister Blair Boyer ending that report from Catherine Birmingham and Stephanie Smile. Tasmania will become the first Australian state to pay reparations to people charged or convicted for being homosexual. The state was the last in Australia to repeal its anti-gay laws in the late 1990s. But advocates say now it's time for the rest of the country to follow Tasmania's lead. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
Australian democracy!
After decades of protests, Tasmania decriminalised homosexuality in 1997, years behind every other state. Laws against cross-dressing remained in place until the early 2000s. Now, decades on, the state's no longer a laggard on gay rights.
This bill represents a watershed moment for Tasmania.
Tasmania's upper house has passed legislation establishing a redress scheme for those charged or convicted of those crimes who have their records expunged. Independent MP Ruth Forrest addressed the chamber ahead of the vote.
When this bill passes, and I'm confident it will, Tasmania will have one of the most comprehensive and compassionate schemes in the world for addressing historical injustices against LGBTIQA+ people. But we must also recognise that no amount of money can fully compensate for decades of discrimination, stigma and trauma.
The move has been welcomed by Rodney Croom, a long-time advocate and a spokesperson for Equality Tasmania.
We have to remember the terrible pain and trauma that was suffered by people who were arrested and convicted under our former laws against homosexuality or cross-dressing. Their trials were in the Supreme Court, so it was in the newspaper. They were often outed involuntarily. Many lost their jobs. They were ostracised from their families. They lost their relationships. Some lost their housing. And there were some who took their own lives.
Rodney Croom believes the redress scheme sends a signal that the state acknowledges the profound pain felt by those affected.
I've spoken to several men about this, and they've said to me, like, several tens of thousands of dollars really won't that make that much difference in and of itself. But it will make a difference when it comes to getting past what happened, being healed from what happened, and feeling a sense that people care.
It's incredibly significant because Tasmania has become the first jurisdiction in Australia to provide financial redress to the people who were harmed by these laws criminalising same-sex sexual conduct.
Paula Gerber is a law professor with Monash University.
Leaders of each state have apologised for these laws and said they were wrong now and they were wrong then and we never should have done this. But nobody until today has said, actually, we need to do more to help these people heal and recover.
The scheme will provide $15,000 for people charged under the laws but not convicted, $45,000 for people charged and convicted but who did not serve a custodial sentence, and $75,000 for people who were charged, convicted and imprisoned. Professor Gerber believes other states can now follow Tasmania's lead.
The fact that we have a really good model in Tasmania that has been well researched and is a very simple and straightforward model to implement, and now just pick that up and run with it.
For Rodney Croom, the scheme is a victory.
Tasmania has leapfrogged the other states, and we now have some of the best LGBTIQA plus legal rights in not only Australia but in the world. The financial redress that has passed the Tasmanian Parliament is a seal on that. It's a sign of how far we've come.
Equality Tasmania's Rodney Croom ending that report from Alexandra Humphreys. If that story raised concerns for you or anyone you know, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. This is PM. I'm Nick Grimm. Remember, you can hear all our programs either live or later on the ABC Listen app. Coming up, one outback Queensland town's secret for securing a new permanent doctor. After causing devastation in the Philippines, a powerful typhoon is tonight continuing to make its way through Southeast Asia, with the storm expected to make landfall in Vietnam early tomorrow. Hundreds of thousands of people have already been forced to flee their homes in the central Philippines after Typhoon Kalmagi brought destructive winds and devastating floods to the region. The storm has killed at least 114 people, but the death toll continues to rise, with dozens of people still unaccounted for. Rachel Mealy reports.
As waters rose in Cebu in the central Philippines, Marlon Enriquez fled his home.
The floodwaters quickly rushed in and we were not able to bring anything with us. This was the first time that has happened to us. I've been living here for almost 16 years and it was the first time I've experienced the flooding.
The raging torrent of floodwater brought by Typhoon Kalmagi moved through the city, sweeping everything in its path. On the street outside Marlon's home, cars are stacked on top of each other. Thick mud covers every surface as he tries to sort through what's left of his belongings.
For now, I have a mix of emotions. There's sadness and uncertainty on how we can recover. It was a total loss. We weren't able to salvage anything, not even our clothes. Whoever is out there who can help us, we would be really grateful.
More than 110 people have been killed in the Philippines, with more than 100 others still missing. Officials say most of the deaths were due to drowning. Lucille Latonio works for the aid organisation World Vision. She lives in Mandaway City in Cebu and says as the storm passed, it brought violent winds.
My kids and I, my husband and I, were just huddled at the ground floor because we were scared. We were just praying. Since we could hear the debris hitting our roof, we could hear the branches of the trees hitting our windows. So there was nothing that we could do. And we could hear our neighbors shouting since some of their stuff were blown away by the wind. What was really very heartbreaking was when the wind died down, I fell asleep. But when I woke up, my phone was filled of pleas for help from our friends, from our colleagues, from my churchmates who were asking to be rescued since they were on top of their houses. Their houses were, it was only the roof of their house that was seen.
The typhoon has hit the Philippines just over a month after a magnitude 6.9 earthquake killed dozens in northern Cebu. The Philippines government says it sent the military and the Coast Guard to the affected regions to clear debris and rescue people. Lucille Latonio says the immediate needs of people in the affected region are overwhelming and more help is urgently needed.
Because of the scale of the damages, because of the scale and the help that is needed, they couldn't respond to every request or they couldn't respond to the help needed. So our governor is asking and appealing for help to the national level if they could send more people here to help. And even I think international help would also be needed if looking at the scale of the devastation.
But Typhoon Kalmagi isn't finished yet. It's currently heading west through the South China Sea towards Vietnam. Vo Quang Khu lives in Hoi An in Vietnam, where the typhoon's expected to make landfall early tomorrow morning.
The typhoon will come to Vietnam, like the middle of Vietnam, like Hoi An, Da Nang, in a few hours. And we are now preparing something to against the typhoon. Yeah, like our house, we make it more tighter.
He says many people have seen the devastation Typhoon Kalmagi brought to the Philippines and are hoping it's losing some of its force.
At the moment, most of us are very nervous about the typhoon. We are used to it because we have a typhoon every year. But yeah, we still are a little bit nervous.
Vo Quang Khu is a tour guide from the central Vietnamese city of Hoi An, ending that report from Rachel Mealy and Alison Chow. For many regional areas, it's a familiar problem, how to get health professionals to take up jobs in what can be some of the most remote parts of the country. Well, the Queensland town of Julia Creek, just east of Mount Isa, and with a population of just 550 residents, has just had success securing the services of a new GP. The town mounted a viral campaign offering a pay packet of more than $600,000 a year, plus a house and a car for the successful applicant. But did it work? Maddie Nixon reports.
It was the job ad that went viral.
The remote township of Julia Creek in far northwestern Queensland is looking for a new doctor, and it's dangling a very big carrot to get the right person.
The carrot in question was a pay packet of $600,000 annually, and the campaign attracted 95 applicants from all over the world. But that's not how the winning recruit found out about the role.
I heard about this job actually from my younger brother, who used to drive road trains across the Top End, and he'd heard about it on the ABC radio when they were talking about it at some stage.
Dr. Pip Bunting says she and her brother were back home on the family's cattle station near Mudgee when the conversation came up.
Having a beer one afternoon out the front, and I said, "Oh, I'm really looking for a new challenge now." And he said, "Oh, what about Julia Creek? It's a great little place. I used to stop there for my COVID test when I was up there driving." And that's how I found out about it. And then, of course, from there, I'd heard about all this sort of stuff that it was going on in the background with the viral campaign. But honestly, it was a discussion with him, not the campaign itself.
While the remuneration might seem appealing, that sort of salary isn't out of the ordinary for rural generalist positions in remote areas. The job operates out of the Julia Creek Multipurpose Health Service with an emergency department, general practice and aged care support. The 95 applicants were shortlisted down to 8, all of whom were Australian qualified rural generalist doctors.
It was beyond what we thought we would have attracted to this role.
Sean Burgeon is the chief executive of the Northwest Hospital and Health Service.
And they were varying, levels of suitability, and hence, we the team shortlisted down to 8 applicants. But it was really, I think, as a result of the advertising campaign and the involvement of the McKinlay Shire Council.
He says the McKinlay Shire Council and Mayor Janine Fegan played a big part in selling the Julia Creek magic.
The mayor wasn't out there talking about the clinical role itself and what's required. That's what my team would do. But what the mayor did was actually sell what Julia Creek has to offer. And certainly the questions that were brought in by many of the applicants in that had applied for this job were very keen to learn more and to experience what, you know, remote Queensland has to offer, particularly in this community of Julia Creek.
And he's confident Dr. Bunting is the perfect person for the job.
You know, somebody that chooses to take on or even apply for these roles, you know, the level of experience is really important. The responsibilities that they have in these small communities are also very extensive.
2 months into the job, Dr. Bunting says no 2 days look the same.
Some days can be really busy and other days are kind of more of that controlled chaos situation, I guess, but, you know, entirely manageable.
And even on those really busy days, there's always a silver lining.
What a great place to work when every day ends with a magic kind of Julia Creek sunset.
Dr. Pip Bunting ending that report from Maddie Nixon. Finally, tonight, they're the silent sentinels watching over the city and keeping it safe from marauding thieves who've made it their life's work to steal our chips. If you go to Sydney's Opera House and Barangaroo areas, you're likely to encounter the fearless canine recruits of the Seagull Patrol, providing four-legged protection against the depredations of the bothersome birds intent on pinching the food off our plates. The program has proved so successful that it's now being introduced in Melbourne as well. Julia Bergen reports.
The sun's out, the view's perfect, and there's a fresh serve of hot chips waiting to be eaten. But that ideal afternoon comes crashing down, all thanks to some thieving seagulls.
Everywhere we went last night, there were seagulls. They were flying in through our heads, but I haven't seen many since I've spotted that dog, actually.
That dog is Scarlett. She's a border collie with a harness that reads Seagull Patrol. Her job, along with a team of other Kelpies and German Shepherds, is to protect patrons and their plates from the flocks of seagulls that frequent Sydney's famous Circular Quay Strip.
The seagulls, sitting on the backs of the chairs and on the tables, ready to pounce as soon as anybody left their table. And as soon as they left, thousands of these seagulls came and descended on the table. It was really, really confronting for us because we certainly don't have anything like that in Melbourne.
Good job.
Scarlett's a regular on the beat. She typically runs an afternoon shift, but in summer works as late as 8 p.m. She's unfazed by the crowds of humans, but remains alert, scanning for birds. Her handler, Ashley Englefield, says she won't chase or bark at them unless instructed.
They have a command to go after the bird. But as you can see, she looks around for them, but she won't do anything until you tell her to.
The Circular Quay Patrol has been running since 2019, and in that time, the dogs have even learned to tell the difference between species of birds.
They will not bother with pigeons or any other bird. They specifically will only go for seagulls. I think that's because the pigeons actually tidy up. They kind of clean up the floor, but the seagulls are the ones that steal your food.
The operation has proved so effective that other states are jumping on board.
We just started in Melbourne. We're actually starting officially next week, so I'm just down here at the moment training the dogs.
James Webb is the director of Mad Dogs and Englishmen Seagull Patrol.
We train the dogs to target the seagulls, so just having a dog walking around won't really have any effect. So the dog you might have seen at Barangaroo, we train them to sort of stare at the seagulls and stalk them on command and run when we tell them and look up, look down. We can even tell them which specific seagull to fix on.
For decades, the Opera House had problems with seagull chip thieves. Nothing was working. When they saw the Australian National Maritime Museum had hired a seagull security dog, they reached out to James Webb for some of their own.
They were like, wow, this is the only thing that's actually works. So the seagulls weren't just flying off with everybody's lunches and everyone was able to enjoy their meals, and then we've been there ever since.
From the middle of November, seven border collies, Kelpies and Australian Shepherds will patrol Melbourne's Federation Square daily for the next 6 months to keep the food-snatching seagulls away from picnickers and diners. Back at Sydney Harbour, Ashley Englefield says the initiative isn't just good for businesses and their customers.
Where they're working dogs, it's good for them to have a purpose. It keeps them more happy and fulfilled physically and mentally. So they end up with a happier dog.
We're all happier, I think. Dog handler Ashley Englefield ending that report by Julia Bergen. And that's our show. Thanks for joining me and the rest of the PM team. I'm Nick Grimm. The podcast of the full PM program is available on the ABC Listen app. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It's a dark cloud that's hovered over her Liberal Party leadership since the beginning. And now the Nationals have officially canned net zero. The pressure is on for Susan Lee to do the same. Today, Chief Political Correspondent at The Conversation, Michelle Grattan, on whether Australian voters are willing to give up on the key emission reduction target. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.